Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, opposing the imaginary national emergency on crime.
My name is Josh Ho. I'm a senior policy analyst at Dream.org. Before that, you know, I was unfortunately incarcerated for a few years here in Michigan. And before that, I did a bunch of other stuff. I've had multiple careers, but now mostly I'm a policy analyst at Dream.org and work on criminal justice issues across the country, both in states and at the federal level.
Tell us a bit more about Dream.org.
Sure. It's a not-for-profit organization. And I think like our tagline is that we close prison doors and open doors of opportunity to the green economy. So we do a lot of things. We have kind of a climate kind of part of our organization that works on trying to get climate funding to neighborhoods that don't usually get the funding. We have a group, a bit of our organization that works on criminal justice issues. And I'm very proud of this, that every single person who works in our justice group are all formerly incarcerated. So we all have direct experience and also have experience outside of that. We also run a national cohort every year where we teach other people in states across the country. We're bringing them to, this year we brought them to Oakland, California, and we taught them for a week on how to do what we do in their own states. And those are all directly impacted people. And then, you know, we also have a tech group that also works on trying to, it's kind of about accessibility to tech for people who don't necessarily have access to that kind of like programming and things like that, and incubation and entrepreneurship and things like that. So that's the kind of three big buckets that we operate in. We also have a part of our justice campaign is also this thing called Public Health is Public Safety. And I've actually had you on one of our webinars for that before. And that's mostly dealing with trying to look at a different way of dealing with kind of addiction and narcotics and other things like that to make it less about being punitive and more about, you know, health, public health. So those are the kind of main buckets of the things that we do.
Let's get straight to it. This new blog post titled is, "We Should Oppose the Imaginary National Emergency on Crime." Now, what motivated you to write it?
Well, I think really, you know, I mean, there's the instigating action was the president deciding to federalize crime control in Washington, D.C. Really, actually, it started probably before that when the National Guard was sent into California for immigration enforcement. But the predicate for a lot of this was a lot of statements about how we can't trust crime data. And that's kind of what got me really kind of fired up a little bit. And, you know, all the other stuff did, too. Obviously, I'm not very happy about troops doing crime, trying to do crime reduction. But the other thing that I think the thing that really tipped it and really got me starting writing about this, not just in the blog, but in social media and other places, was that a lot of people, I think, in the kind of more traditional wing of the Democratic Party were talking about how it would be a mistake for people on the left or the progressive wing or the Democrats to push back against Trump on these things. And I just found that to be really both problematic and just wrongheaded. I just don't think that's good policy or good politics. And, you know, I mean, those are the two things that most of those folks care about is, you know, how's it going to hurt us in elections? And is it good policy? And so I think you have to consider, even if those aren't the things that motivate you to kind of communicate to those people, I think you have to take their frame and at least try to respond to them in the terms that they might understand.
What is your message then?
My message is that it's actually that crime stats are pretty legitimate, that it's important for a lot of reasons to take crime stats seriously, that it's a bad idea to federalize the military, I mean, federalize crime reduction, that there's a lot of bad impacts to this whole notion of the way they're going about it, and that it's bad politics. I think that's all the, you know, so I think multiple levels of why it's bad policy, and then a little bit on why it's bad politics.
Now, I've been a frequent critic of the Bureau of Justice Statistics and the various state agencies, and the because they are so slow, they drag their feet, and in some cases they're just taking a bloody long time to get out information that really should be more readily available. And it's all the way through from the local to the state, all the way up to the feds. They're horribly underfunded, which is probably one of the reasons that they take so bloody long getting some of that information out there. But as for the quality, these numbers are valid. These numbers are real, and
to pretend that they're 100% accurate, because that's not what the point of any of this is. They're not supposed to give you a literal picture of crime in the sense that you know exactly down to the millisecond you're never going to have a perfect picture of crime, but it does tell you a lot of things, especially if there are multiple corroborating sources and they all go in the same direction. And so to say, like, for instance, when it's right now, what we're dealing with is arguably the largest decline in crime in our lifetimes. We have dropped down to where violent crime in this country is at levels not seen since the early 60s. And that direction is constant no matter what data source you're looking at across all data sets. Even if you don't believe it's gone down that much, or that there's underreporting, or that the numbers are fudged in one place or another, it's a national trend, and it comes across every different reporting source. So you have some confidence that at least the direction is the right way, and that the direction is a fairly steep slope down. Right. And it makes sense, too. Like, if you think about it, a lot of the reason why crime, and I think you could find a million sources that say this, you don't have to listen to me, that a reason that crime went up was because of social dislocation during COVID, and because of, you know, crises in economics and things like that were brought on by the COVID emergency. Before the COVID emergency, crime was on a long downward slope. Then the COVID emergency happened, and there was a spike. After the COVID emergency, that long slope of decline started again. It's not that necessarily, you know, we think that it all has to do with specific policies and specific places and all this kind of stuff. That's really not true. Trends kind of cut across all political areas and all, you know, local, federal, state, all those things. If you see it across a bunch of different places that do totally different things, a lot of times it has nothing to do with policy at all. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't use policies that take advantage of the things that work, which is really what my blog post is about. But it does mean that you can trust, especially when there's a lot of corroborating data across a lot of different data sets, you can at least trust the trends, and you can probably trust the general amount of decline, if that makes sense, or increase if it was an increase.
I'm looking at one of these sections here. Embracing criminal justice reform is good policy and good politics. Give me some examples. What do you mean by this?
Well, for instance, you know, I mean, one thing that, a guy named Roman found when he was doing some research is just having, for instance, the amount of people that you hire in local government has an effect on crime. Okay, so you can look at data through, you know, like I'm saying, through corroborating sets and a lot of other things, and you can see when there's more people who are hired in local government, crime goes down. And then that's correlative, and he has some things that do more than correlate. But that's something that's good to know. So if you ignore crime data, if you just say, okay, we're just going to forget crime data, a lot of what seems to be going on right now is this notion of that there's so much skepticism about expertise that we're taking the baby and throwing it out with the bathwater. We're saying, like, well, this isn't exactly accurate, so we should throw it all out, which doesn't make any sense, because if something's 98% accurate and you need it to try to determine what the best course forward is, then that's better than being 0% accurate or just putting it up to the wind, which is what you do when you throw everything out. And so What I'm saying is that with the policies we've seen that work and are represented in the data set, maybe it's not the entire decline, but it's part of the decline. That's how we determine how to make investments. We say, this is working, this is working, this is working. Let's invest more in the things that are working and less in the things that aren't working. That's part of why data is important. And we can do studies using the data to determine what things are more successful and less successful. And that's really how we move forward as a general rule with all good policy. You know, I mean, we don't just kind of come up with an idea and, you know, hope. I mean, sometimes we do, unfortunately, come up with an idea that's a bad idea and we just throw it up there and we haven't done any testing or we have no idea why it's going to be a good idea. But it's probably better to know, especially in this area, because, you know, I think one of the misnomers that you hear all the time is that people who work in criminal justice reform don't care about crime and violence. That's about as far from true as you could possibly be. In fact, most of the people I work with, and including myself, have seen or experienced as much violence as probably anyone in the country. We want nothing more than to have safe communities. We don't like, I mean, we've lived through incredible traumas. We don't want to be surrounded by that trauma anymore. You know, so a lot of what we're trying to do is find things that work and try to invest in those things and try to make our communities safer, you know? And so that's what I think the project is. So when I start talking about why we need to get the policy right, it's because that means we'll have less crime, less victims, less, you know, problems in our communities, et cetera. I mean, we have a lot of, you know, the tough on crime people have, in theory, at least, you know, they at least will say they have the same goals, but to say that we're not invested in trying to make our community safer is wildly inaccurate.
Well, let's talk about the tough on crime people for a moment. Another section of your piece, normalizing militarized police is dangerous for Americans. There is a school of thought that if we just threaten people with worse and worse punishments, if we just threaten people and basically like an animal, stand up real big and puff ourselves out and roar, growl a little louder, that everything will be, that people will stop committing crimes. You know, it's like parents just keep threatening your kid with being grounded, threatening your kid with a cutting off this and that, threatening. And that's why I never raised kids, but I was a kid, and that didn't work for me, and that didn't work on anyone I knew, right? But
doesn't work. The data doesn't bear it out either. You know, I mean, basically with the subject of deterrence, what there is a, you can see in the research on deterrence that if you have a certainty of punishment, there is a somewhat robust deterrent effect. I'm not saying it's a massive, it doesn't stop crime and it's, but there is an effect from the certainty of punishment. There is not, however, any such effect from the degree of punishment. In other words, severe punishment doesn't make crime go down any more than anything else. Certainty of punishment might, because it's not like 60% falls off the thing. And part of that's because what causes crime has very little to do with punishment, right? Like, you don't start going to the store to rob something because someone threatened to punish you or not to punish you. You go because you don't have the money to buy food. You know, I mean, there are probably exceptions to that. I'm not saying that's 100% of the time. But, you know, they're, you know, for a large amount of people who are, you know, trying to steal food, the reason is because they're hungry. You know, and if you're not addressing that problem, you're not really solving that crime. And on top of that, there's also another misnomer that people have, is that, like, somehow everyone who is committing crimes has memorized the criminal code. You know, I mean, like, they sit around and they know, like, oh, well, that might violate 353.2678, which means I'd get an enhancement or whatever. You know, they don't have like a working memory of the, you know, maybe some do, but, you know, I don't think most people who are committing crimes in a moment of passion, like a violent crime is usually a moment of passion, that you all of a sudden go, hold on, I have this personal issue with this other person and we're getting in a fight right now. I'm going to stop that because there's a obscure part of the code that says if I do it this way, I'll get an enhancement, and that means I'll do more time, which means I should, you know, stop right now. I mean, that's probably not the way it works in most cases. At least that hasn't been my experience in areas where I've seen crimes happen or been around crimes. But there's a second level, which I think is really important too. I'm sorry to jump around a little bit, but the second level is it's not just a question of, like, the reason why policy is important is it teaches us how to better address crime. So if we're really can you know, if we're in an area that really needs some work on trying to reduce crime, there's a lot of things we could try to do, and several things that have worked, like violence interruption, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you know, having more people in the civil service, you know, there's all kinds of things that have been tried and have worked that you could apply perhaps. That's different than sending in the military. And there's another level beyond the crime reduction thing that is a problem of applying the military to something that's not a military problem. And that's the reason why the founders and, you know, especially if this, you know, and a lot of other people over time have tried to put firewalls between the military and domestic enforcement. And the reason for that is because that's the bluntest of instruments, and they have no expertise in this area. And they do, even by their presence, have a, effect on the liberty of the people in the area that they're surveilling or that they're enforcing. So, like, if I'm walking around in DC and there are, you know, military people with rifles all over the place, and I'm being surveilled 24/7 by drones and cameras everywhere and things like that, that has an effect on my freedom and my liberty. And at some level, this experiment that we're all a part of has something to do with preserving liberty. At least in theory, right? So, like, the idea is, what are you going to sacrifice your liberty for? I would rather put investments in things that don't sacrifice my liberty and reduce crime than things that reduce my liberty and probably don't decrease crime. That's kind of the point I was making. I think we should hold our liberty more preciously than people seem to think is important. I don't want the military all over the country, and I just don't think that's a good idea for any number of reasons.
This is my conversation with Josh Ho, Senior Policy Manager at Dream.org. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Go back to a moment. You mentioned the certainty of being caught in punishment, the certainty rather than the severity. And when that, I do data, and one of the data points that that I always love to talk about is the clearance rate, which you take the number of known criminal offenses, the property crimes, the violent crimes, and then you determine how many of those were cleared by basically an arrest or an indictment. It doesn't mean that anybody was ever found guilty. It just means that the authorities found someone to take the to pin the blame on. I mean, they don't prevent crime, and the problem of solving crime, you have, less than 20% of all property offenses that are known to the authorities, that are reported crimes, less than 20%, more like about 15 or 14% are ever cleared with some kind of an arrest or an indictment. With violent crimes, it's under 50%. And again, these are only the reported crimes. So those crimes that go unreported, and there are large numbers of crimes that go unreported, the criminal victimization surveys, which is one of the other really important bits of data that the Bureau of Justice Statistics works on, show that there are loads of crimes, great proportion of them, that are never reported. So that police rarely solve crime as it is, which is that, you know, because we have this ridiculous notion of an occupying army instead of, you know, working with a community and trying to make things better. And that's not a question. I just wanted to bring that up. But it plays back into the point that crime statistics are important and they do show us something. And I think if we look at the fact that police don't really do a good job of, you know, solving crimes, let alone preventing them, that it would, I think, move people toward toward the notion that we need to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, two little pieces of thing here. The first one is, you're right that, you know, like, everyone always says, well, who are you going to call when you've been robbed? Well, that's true. You're probably going to call the police, but the robbery's already happened. You know, they don't prevent that from happening. They respond to it happening. And so I think you're right there. The only thing, you know, from my position, I obviously am more on your side than the other, but I probably should at least mention that there is pretty good data that suggests that when police are present in a particular place at a particular time, that they deter crime. In other words, if you see a police officer, you're probably not going to try to shoot somebody right in front of the police officer. or rob them or whatever it is. Maybe you still will, but the likelihood is less when they're in a particular place in a particular time. And the problem with that is that if you extend that out, that means that you put police in every particular place at every particular time. And that's my point about liberty. If there's other ways that we can reduce crime that don't require police in every single place and every single time and us being surveilled 24/7, I would prefer we did that. And on top of that, you know, I was just going to say, I don't know if even that would cause us to solve crime in the way that, you know, sometimes Trump seems to suggest that somehow crime will just stop. You know, I mean, that the reasons why crime happen have a lot to do with places to conditions and people and situations that aren't solved by massive deterrence.
If you're someone who, you know, physically looks like one of the usual suspects, and I don't mean characters from that particular movie, I mean the kind of person who is consistently being harassed by police and is always being brought in, always being questioned, whether they're doing anything or not. They're just, you know, maybe they're unhoused, maybe they're just poorly dressed. They might be, and probably are, a Black, Indigenous, or other person of color. There could be any number of reasons why they're being harassed, and what you end up doing with that extra police presence is you discourage people from being in public spaces. You discourage people from going out. I mean, if you want to stop people from going to a syringe exchange, then you just put cops there on the corner. And that has actually been that we have research to show that that by increasing the police presence around a syringe exchange, people are less likely to frequent that syringe exchange, which means more people will get HIV, more people will get hepatitis C, people will have wounds going untreated, and oh yes, there will be more needle litter. There's a lot of reasons for syringe exchange, a lot of reasons for harm reduction programs, and that's, you know, that's one of the things that police presence, stops.
And we're seeing that happen in D.C. right now. One of the things that I didn't mention that I think is really bad about this whole federalization is part of the point of the federalization is to, in essence, take all the people who are unhoused in the D.C. area and either move them to facilities, which we can discuss, or to incarceration. You know, and this is part of a outgrowth of the Supreme Court case of Grants Pass, which happened last year, which in essence allows states and localities to move unhoused people to camps or whatever outside of the main areas of where people live or where people who aren't unhoused live. I don't want to suggest that only the people, because I obviously am very upset by this part of it, because to me, people who are unhoused because of poverty, mental illness, drug addiction, whatever reason that it is, to me, these are the people we should care about the most, not the least. And the idea that we are taking what life they have and destroying it and putting them in, you know, questionable, whatever, wherever they're going to put them, which I can't imagine is going to be a place that they would consent to outside of this action, is very troubling to me. So it's not just kind of our general idea of liberty. It has very specific liberty implications for a particular class of folks. And they are the folks who, in many cases, have the least amongst us. And so that's, you know, very, very upsetting to me and very troubling.
What can people do?
Well, I mean, there's a large, I think, panoply of things that you can choose from. And I think the important thing is to find out or to figure out what you feel comfortable doing and do that. A lot of times people will say, look, you know, here's the answer, do this. There is no answer. There's no one answer. And anything I say is probably tied to what I do, you know, but there's a large range of responses. And I think the first and easiest thing to do is to find other people who are concerned in your area and start to work with them to figure out what in your area you can do, you know, because I think everything always starts at some level, you know, in the neighborhoods where you're at. and finding other people like you who are interested in the same thing, who are going to work together to organize, to change the area where you are. You know, that can then build to something that's statewide, or it can build to something that's nationwide, or you can connect with other people in other localities and other states and things like that. And I know none of that sounds like an easy, here's something you can do, but I do think it's important, and I really believe this, to find the people proximate to you who are doing this, doing work in this area, and getting together with them. It makes things a lot easier when you have a group of people and you're working together. You know, I tell this story, there's a group in Michigan that, you know, for years, this group of, they're basically people who were parents whose kids were incarcerated, and they met each other at a support group, and they started to make it more of a political group, and they started going to the Capitol, you know, probably once a month. And there are multiple times where laws would have been worse, or where laws didn't pass, or where good laws passed, because these people spent years going to every single office once a month. This never fails, never stop, having these conversations with their legislators and things like that. And that can happen at the local level, that can happen at the state level, that can happen at the federal level. But having that group of people that supported each other through that and never stopped going, no matter how they showed up the first time and no one listened to them. The second time, no one listened to them. But because they were together, they could keep going, and they could keep going, and they could keep going because they were giving each other strength.
What have I not asked yet that I should have?
Oh, I don't know. You've done, I think, a really good job of asking, I think, what are the important questions. I mean, I just want to reiterate that, you know, the final, what really matters at the end of the day is, what are the American people willing to support? And, you know, that's, when I talk about all this stuff, you know, what I'm really talking about is, what are we willing to support? Are we willing to give up our liberty to have a little bit more safety? You know, as Ben Franklin, I'm kind of paraphrasing, once said, you know, that you shouldn't, you know, that you don't deserve either if you sacrifice your liberty for safety. That is the worst paraphrase in the history of the world. But it's an important point. You know, we have to, at some level, stand up for our own rights. And we can't let fear, especially when there's other things, you know, I know for a fact that there are a lot of other things that work to reduce crime. We could get together and make sure those things are happening in our communities, and not sacrifice our liberty and not give in to these terrible things and not allow our unhoused brothers and sisters to be shipped off to Siberia or wherever the hell they're going to send them, if they don't agree to incarceration, which is the supposedly the question that they're putting to them. So I'm just saying that, you know, we have to do what we can do, whatever we can do. If we don't do it, no one else is going to do it for us.
That was my conversation with Josh Ho, Senior Policy Manager at Dream.org. For now, that's it. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Just so long! Intention.